What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Ambassador Dennis Ross, renowned authority on the Middle East and author of a new book on it called Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, we commemorated the 20th anniversary of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel. It's hard to comprehend that it has been two decades since the Orthodox Jewish assassin, Yigal Amir, may his memory be forgotten, murdered Rabin in that giant square in Tel Aviv in 1995. It's harder still to imagine how different history might have turned out without that one terrible act. Last Saturday night, 100,000 people gathered in what is now called Rabin Square in the heart of Tel Aviv to hear speeches and remember. Former President Bill Clinton was there in person and spoke movingly about his friend, again paying tribute to Rabin's courage and character. President Barack Obama sent a video tribute. Clinton gave a rousing speech urging Israelis to complete Rabin's work by making peace with the Palestinians, saying Rabin knew that the risks of peace were less severe than the risks of walking away from peace. Clinton has said many times that if Rabin had lived, there would have been peace with the Palestinians in 3 years, because both sides trusted Yitzhak Rabin. It is profoundly sad and somewhat astonishing that Rabin's death is now 20 years ago, and that, if anything, we are much farther from peace with the Palestinians than we were at the start of that Oslo process. Ironically, and little remembered, the peace process between the Israelis and Palestinians actually began at a conference in Madrid, Spain in 1991, when Yitzhak Shamir was prime minister and his young, dynamic, smooth-talking deputy foreign minister was Benjamin Netanyahu, the star of that conference. The process that led to Oslo was forced on the Israeli leadership by the first President George Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker, and it led eventually to the election of Rabin and the turn towards peace with the Palestinians. A series of agreements were completed. Cooperation began in earnest. Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres shared a Nobel Peace Prize, but that hope-filled process began to come to an end with Rabin's assassination in November of 95. The real end of the peace process may not have occurred until the year 2000 with the explosion of the Second Intifada, but most people believe that only Rabin would have managed things to a different result, with the creation of a demilitarized Palestinian state and an enduring peace between Israel and the Palestinians. That hope, in many ways, ended 20 years ago. To play us in this morning, here's the Israeli song that's become a memorial song for Yitzhak Rabin, the song that was sung just before he was shot, the song whose blood-stained lyrics were found in his jacket pocket. This was originally written in 1970 and was sung often in the sad days of the Yom Kippur War, Shir LeShalom, a song of peace.
Thank you.
That was Shir LeShalom, the Song of Peace, in memory of the great Yitzhak Rabin, whose death 20 years ago last week changed the course of the history of Israel and the Palestinians dramatically and for the worse. History, however, is rarely truly inevitable, especially in the Middle East, and today we'll hear from a man involved with much of that history over the last several decades. When we come back in a few moments, we'll meet our special guest, Ambassador Dennis Ross, one of the authors of U.S. policy over the last 40 years in the Middle East, an important actor in it himself, and the author of a new book on U.S.-Israel relations, doomed to succeed, the U.S.-Israel relationship from Truman to Obama. Meet him when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award in 2016, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our special guest this morning, Ambassador Dennis Ross, a diplomat and author, was director of policy planning in the State Department all the way back under President George H.W. Bush, the special Middle East coordinator under President Bill Clinton, a special advisor for the Persian Gulf and Southwest Asia under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and has served both in government and think tank work and written extensively. He has a new book out about the Israeli-American relationship called Doomed to Success. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Nice to be with you.
So a brief question about right now. Mahmoud Abbas has abrogated the last of the Oslo treaties. You were involved in creating the Madrid Conference, which led to the Oslo treaties. What does that mean for those of us who are not diplomats?
Well, I think we have to be careful in terms of exactly what he did and what he didn't do. What he said is he no longer felt obligated to fulfill the obligations under the Oslo agreements. He didn't say he wouldn't implement them. So he didn't say, I'm abrogating. He said, I no longer feel obligated to fulfill those obligations. At this point, he's actually not walked away from those obligations. The security cooperation continues. The Israelis are continuing to collect the taxes for them. And in effect, what he did is make a kind of symbolic statement, which unfortunately seems to be all too often the norm for the Palestinian National Movement, where the tendency is to focus far more on symbols than it is on substance.
And now, of course, in a period of renewed violence, primarily symbolic, based on claims that the religious Jews are going to take over the Temple Mount, is there hope for some future moderation coming out of all this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is a really, I think, difficult time. And it's in some ways, it simply reflects what is a deeper reality right now. The Israeli public doesn't have any faith in the Palestinians, and the Palestinian public doesn't have any faith in the Israelis. There's a profound disbelief, and what adds to the disbelief on the Israeli side is the kind of continuing emphasis of spreading untruths, spreading lies. I mean, the very point you were raising, the real narrative that is out there among the Palestinians is that the Israelis are going to do to the Al-Aqsa Mosque what exists in Hebron, where you have the tomb of Abraham and you have Ibrahimi Mosque, and effectively it's a site that's shared. And so they've been spreading this notion that this is what the Israelis are planning to do, which is completely untrue. It is triggering a lot of the violence, and most of the violence is being carried out by 15 to 25-year-olds, and when they're captured, they're saying, we did it for Al-Aqsa, like they're protecting Al-Aqsa. And that's, you know, the one place to start here is start telling the truth. Stop spreading lies. You know, the incitement serves nobody's interest, and actually is bad even from Abu Mazen's standpoint, meaning Mahmoud Abbas. So, you know, I think we're at a very difficult time, and unless you can begin to restore faith and belief in the idea of coexistence, we're going to find that the difficult period, the dark period we're going through, is going to be sustained. It's not going to be stopped.
We will talk much more with Ambassador Dennis Ross, our special guest this morning here on Too Jewish, when we return in just a moment.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We have 12 months until we elect a new president of these United States, and we continue our special election year plus feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report, in-depth coverage, unusual stories, and the finest opinion on the air as we choose the new leader for our nation. Republican presidential hopeful Ben Carson defended his claim in the last couple of weeks that gun control helped enable the Holocaust, saying some rabbis back his assertion. Carson reiterated his non-factual claim that gun control in Germany, which began in the late 1930s, was a factor enabling the Nazis to perpetrate genocide against the Jews. In the last several weeks, he said, I've heard from many people in the Jewish community, including rabbis, who say you're spot on, you're exactly right. Carson was on the news program Meet the Press after host Chuck Todd observed that the minute you talk about the Holocaust, people stop listening. Hope not. Carson said it is generally agreed that it's much more difficult to dominate people who are armed than people who are not. You know, some people will try to take that and make it into an anti-Jewish thing, which is foolishness. He first made the claim about gun control in the Holocaust in an interview on CNN. I think the likelihood of Hitler being able to accomplish his goals would have been greatly diminished if the people had been armed, Carson said on October 8th. Carson has previously defended his comments, which were also made in his latest book. It's not hyperbole at all, Carson told CBS in early October and added that he never intended to diminish the Holocaust. Well, while there may be some rabbis who think that Nazi Germany's gun control laws contributed to the Holocaust, I suspect that all the sane ones understand that is hooey. Carson's argument is counterfactual, that is, a fantasy based on the question of what would have happened if this had been true instead of what really happened. In fact, gun control laws were quite strict in Germany under the Weimar Republic, before Hitler, and the idea that if Jews, just 1% of the population of Germany, had been armed, they would have been able to resist the might of the Nazi war machine and the SS is truly absurd, insulting to the intelligence and, frankly, the feelings of all Jews. Even if Ben Carson doesn't think so. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our Mivi Nod Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Last week we commemorated the English calendar, American calendar, 20th anniversary of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, 1995. Very traumatic event. You and I have talked about how we Jews are always kind of post-trauma from the Holocaust or all of the traumas of our history, the wars in Israel. But this event really partially shaped a generation of Israelis from an Israeli perspective.
Definitely. I would say it's one of the tipping point or milestones, if you want. Like there is kids that were born after Rabin or been, you know, at least, I would say born after and raised on his heritage and with the, huge trauma of an Israeli prime minister assassinated by not by a Palestinian, not by a terrorist, by an Israeli religious guy, and on one hand, I think it's allow a lot of talks about peace, promoting peace, hearing the other side, this kind of a lot of programs, and Rabin and Peres Center for Peace also promoting this kind of programs, but also. I can say, a little bit, even with a little bit shame, that I think this generation being raised a little bit to understand the Palestinian side, but not always to understand the other sides of the Israeli society, the Jewish society. And for that part, I'm a little bit sad because, first you need to have a peace among
yourselves before
yourself,
you can make
your family,
peace with other
your community
people.
Before, and then you can do peace with others. So...
That's really the great lesson of that Tikkun Olam story. You have to start at home before you can reach across the aisle, reach out to other people. There was always this dream of peace in Israel. It's not that everybody thought it was realistic, but with Rabin, for a while there, after the Oslo process, for 5, 6, maybe even 7 years, there was this sense that really it was going to work. What percentage of the Israeli population really believes that there's going to be a day when it will really work at this point?
Back then, as I remember, it was a huge, a real hope. Mm-hmm. And I think it was not just hope, it was a realistic hope.
Yeah, consensus of the population.
It seems like it's around the corner. Finally we have the right leaders, both sides that really can take the risk and do... the best, from Arafat's side, from Israel, it was Peres and Rabin. It's really, Israel was, I think, in that point, the hopeful point that I can remember.
Right. And not quite like that now.
Yeah.
Thanks, Oshrat. We will talk next week.
Toda rabba.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you have been traveling, going wine tasting in various regions. There are kosher wines and not kosher wines, and then there's a whole gradation about who values which level of kosher wines, and there's good kosher wines, certainly not just from Israel, but from a variety of places around the world.
Right. Virtually every great wine-producing country produces some kosher wines, either in wineries where the total output is kosher or in wineries where some of the wine is kosher. And I'll leave it to you, if you don't mind, to define for your listeners what makes wine kosher or not kosher, and how can something that is essentially grape juice
right.
be possibly non-kosher? That's a question we'll come to in a minute.
Okay.
But let me say that two of my very recent trips, in fact, within the past month, one was to a great wine-producing region in northern Italy, the area around Verona, where Amarone and Valpolicella and lots of other great wines are produced. And the other was to the Willamette Valley just outside of Portland, Oregon. It's about 40, 45 minutes from downtown Portland. And that area produces, in my opinion, the best wines in the whole hemisphere. And
wow.
I had
high praise indeed.
Right. Well, I had a guy from Mendoza, Argentina, which is the capital of the whole wine industry in South America, in tow. And I had to convince him of my oft-repeated contention that he was visiting the area that produced the best wines in the hemisphere. And he's very skeptical. But at the end of 36 hours there, he was sold.
Wow.
So,
you know, it's fascinating because the notion that kosher wine is Manischewitz, I think, has long passed vogue. And people understand there's very fine wines that are made that meet kosher specifications. It isn't, in some ways, terribly hard. The big idea behind kosher wines is that they weren't used for pagan rituals in the ancient world, and the idea that wine, therefore, had to be carefully watched. And in fact, if you're really ultra-Orthodox about it, it can only be handled by Jews, actually, unless it's boiled, yayin yemuv u'shal, which some people think ruins the wine and some people think doesn't affect the wine at all. So there's debates about it. But there are a number of different kind of categories, even of kosher wine, for those people who are careful about observing that.
Right. Well, I'd like you to go into some detail about this before I go on and on about wine regions, because I used to go to a kosher restaurant in Paris that was glatt kosher. I mean, people who were very, very observant would eat there. And they had a guy from Mauritius who made the desserts and poured most of the alcoholic drinks, except for the wine. Right. The wine bottles, which were all kosher, mostly produced in France, but a huge variety of kosher wines produced in France, would be brought to the table and opened by a guy wearing a kippah, an observant Orthodox Jew, who would be the one to open and pour your wine. I think that maybe once it was open and the first glass had been poured, someone else could pour from that same bottle, if I remember correctly, but I can't even swear to that. So the mysteries and details of this, maybe we should go into next session, because I think it's important, it's interesting, and it was also a root cause of anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism in the ancient world.
We will talk about it, continue this discussion next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th, 2016, to the Holy Land. If you're interested in going on this fantastic pilgrimage journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email toojewishradio18@gmail.com, toojewishradio18@gmail.com, or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Miriam notices that whenever her 5-year-old daughter Sarah is asked her name, she answers, "I'm Mr. Friedman's daughter." So one day, just before bedtime, Miriam says to Sarah, "Honey, whenever anyone asks you what your name is, don't say, 'I'm Mr. Friedman's daughter.' Instead, you have to proudly say, 'My name is Sarah.' Sarah is such a beautiful name. The Bible tells us that another lovely Sarah was the wife of Abraham and the mother of Isaac." "Okay, Mommy," says Sarah. Later that week, the rabbi is visiting Sarah's class, and as soon as he sees her, he goes over to Sarah and says, "Hello, aren't you Mr. Friedman's daughter?" "I thought I was," replies Sarah, "but my mommy says I'm not." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. The story of the twins, Jacob and Esau, begins in utero. Rivals from before birth, wrestling in their mother Rebekah's womb, the red-haired outdoorsman Esau and his grasping, domestically inclined younger brother Jacob, spend our portion of Toldot vying for their father's and mother's love and attention. Each is partly successful and each partly fails. That sibling rivalry shaped the course of our people's early history, but it can also teach us something about ourselves. First, a word about words. Toldot is rich in real-life details told in spectacularly perfect writing. Rebecca, pregnant with the two boys wrestling inside her, tells God, "If it's like this, why am I alive?" Prefiguring the words every pregnant mom thinks or says at some point. Esau is hairy and rough at birth, Jacob smooth, born holding fast to Esau's heel. Esau, famished from a long hunt, trades his birthright for a bowl of stew, and then ate, drank, stood up, left, and disdained, the series of active verbs delineating his turbulent, thoughtless character. Jacob, smooth-faced, smooth-talking lawyer that he is, audibly calculates the coming consequences of each action. Now, on to that little rivalry. The familial tension in Toldot is palpable throughout. In fact, there is source enough to go around for everyone in this small family. Isaac, the father and link between more important patriarchs, finds trouble everywhere but avoids it by simply moving on. Each time he finds more success and then more trouble and moves again. Rebecca sees the wayward ways of her eldest boy Esau and chooses to manipulate the situation to give the inheritance to Jacob, remaking the birth order retroactively. But the great struggle is between Jacob and Esau. I'm reminded of the 1960s TV stars, the Smothers Brothers' old line, "Mom like you best." Mom certainly liked Jacob best. Dad liked Esau best. That kind of favoritism cannot end well, and in the short term it doesn't. At the end of our portion, Esau has been doubly defrauded. Jacob is forced to flee the consequences of his own duplicity, running from the only home he has known without so much as a blanket. In a sense, the conflicted family damages all of its members. Each is wounded, none really left whole. It's a drama worthy of so many of our own lives. And yet, in a couple of more Torah portions, we will see that each member of this now shattered nuclear family has played or will play a central role in furthering God's design for our world. In spite of their mistakes and their injuries, each helps ultimately to carry out pivotal elements that further God's mission and that will create the great people of Israel. In challenging times and in conflicted families, it's often hard to see that ultimately there is a divine plan or a place for each participant within it. But Toldot, which means generations, teaches us that in spite of what we might perceive in our own small field of vision, God is at work in the world, and through all of our struggles, we may very well be furthering a greater plan. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Ambassador Dennis Ross, author of much U.S. policy in the Middle East over the past 30 or so years, will explain why the U.S.-Israel relationship is doomed to succeed, as his new book puts it, and explore the changing alliances and relationships in today's Middle East. All when we come back here on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998 and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers, our brothers.
As knife attacks and other assaults by Palestinian Arabs on innocent Israeli civilians continue, an 80-year-old woman was stabbed on a bus last week, among other Arab obscenities. Pope Francis courageously said that attacks both on Jews and the State of Israel are anti-Semitic. To attack Jews is anti-Semitism, but an outright attack on the State of Israel is also anti-Semitism, the Pope said in a private meeting at the Vatican with Jewish leaders from the World Jewish Congress. There may be political disagreements between governments and on political issues, but the State of Israel has every right to exist in safety and prosperity. WJC President Ron Lauder praised the Pope's comments, saying the relationship between Jews and Catholics has never been stronger. Pope Francis does not simply make declarations, Lauder said. He inspires people with his warmth and his compassion. His clear and unequivocal support for the Jewish people is critical to us. Francis also met publicly with nearly 150 delegates and members of the World Jewish Congress's governing board. The meeting marked the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, the landmark Catholic Church declaration that rejected the charge of Jewish responsibility for the killing of Jesus and helped transform the relationship between Judaism and Catholicism. Author J.K. Rowling defended her decision to oppose a cultural boycott of Israel in a post to her Twitter account. The sharing of art and literature across borders constitutes an immense power for good in this world, Rowling wrote on TwitLonger, a version of Twitter for those who have more to say. The Harry Potter author was criticized by a number of her fans on social media after she joined 150 British artists in signing an open letter published by The Guardian newspaper last week, arguing against a cultural boycott of Israel and for cultural engagement. Rowling addressed what she said were a number of readers asking for more information about why I am not joining a cultural boycott of Israel, saying she had never heard of a cultural boycott ending a bloody and prolonged conflict. At a time when the stigmatization of religions and ethnicities seems to be on the rise, I believe strongly that cultural dialogue and collaboration is more important than ever before, and that cultural boycotts are divisive, discriminatory, and counterproductive, she said. Rowling further argued that the impact of a cultural boycott would be felt predominantly by ordinary Israelis and not by the Israeli government, which she said would be the source of any policy change. She said she has deplored most of Mr. Netanyahu's actions in office, referring to Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. J.K. Rowling, whose Harry Potter books have sold 400 million copies and were adapted into the second highest grossing film series of all time, uses Albus Dumbledore, a headmaster of Hogwarts Wizarding School in the series, to make a moral point about the need for dialogue and cultural engagement with Israel. Dumbledore is an academic. He believes that certain channels of communication should always remain open, Rowling wrote. Dumbledore, she concluded, is the moral heart of the books. He did not consider all weapons equal, and he was prepared always to go to the hilltop to find agreement. Last week, we noted here on Too Jewish that while all the Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians were going on over the past month, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's brother-in-law was undergoing life-saving heart surgery at a private hospital in Tel Aviv. Despite the recent attacks on Israelis by Palestinians, Israel approved the entry of Abbas's wife's brother to receive treatment. The same week, Mahmoud Abbas claimed Israel had executed a Palestinian teenager in cold blood. However, the 13-year-old in question is alive and is being treated in an Israeli hospital despite having participated in a terror attack in which an Israeli boy his own age was critically injured. Abbas has also refused to meet with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to restrain Palestinian violence. He has been throwing gasoline on the fire, actually. But the Israelis are still giving his brother-in-law top-level medical care. This is consistent with Israeli humanitarian policies. Last summer, Amina Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas's wife, was hospitalized and successfully treated at a Souda Medical Center in Tel Aviv, the same place where Abbas's brother-in-law is now being treated. Just last year, Israel also treated the sister of senior official Musa Abu Marzouk for cancer. The hospitalization was one of a number of cases of relatives of Hamas leaders being treated in Israel, despite the terror group's principal goal of destroying Israel and firing missiles at Israel. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh's mother-in-law, daughter, and granddaughter have all received medical treatment in Israeli hospitals, all while Haniyeh continues to work to destroy Israel and slaughter all Jews. Yet Israel provides the highest level of medical care to his family. You know, it's impossible to imagine a scenario in which Israelis or Jews from other nations receive preferential treatment in hospitals of the local Arab countries. But Israel does this regularly because it's the right thing to do, the Jewish thing to do, and the ethical thing to do. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Ambassador Dennis Ross has served the American government in a variety of diplomatic posts, going back to the first President Bush and even before that, working with Paul Wolfowitz, and has a new book out. He may know more about the Middle East and how to make it work than virtually anyone around. The book is called Doomed to Success, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. Let's talk a little bit about present times. President Obama has a very interesting reputation in the Jewish community. I would say it's almost bipolar in terms of how people think about it. Can you discuss a little bit about the way the Obama administration has responded to Israel and what you see at the moment?
Obviously, I served in the administration. I actually was a special assistant to President Obama for 2 years in the White House.
Right.
I left the end of 2011. What I saw was a reality that was really a duality. And what I mean by that is the president had a view of Israel that was split in two. It was, you described a kind of bipolar approach. I would say in some respects there was a kind of bipolar approach by the president as well. When it came to Israel's security, he had a very strong sense that he had a deep obligation to fulfill our obligations to Israel and to stand by Israel when it came to security. He used to say in my presence when I was in the Oval Office that whatever our differences are with Israel, we're going to wall off security. That's sacrosanct. We don't touch that. On the other hand, when it came to the peace issue, he looked at Israel as being strong and the Palestinians as being weak. And the Palestinians, because they were a weak actor, they weren't responsible for anything. He didn't hold them responsible for anything. In many ways, it was as if they were too weak to criticize. And the onus for all action fell on the Israelis. And the problem with that is, aside from the fact that it eroded, I think, his credibility with the Israeli public, it also gave the Palestinians a pass. For Palestinians, the very idea of compromise is considered illegitimate because the sense of their own grievance, their sense of victimhood, their deep wounds, the way they see it, the wrongs that have been done to them, the way they see it, may put them in a position where they feel nothing should be asked of them. They should never be in a position where they have to make a concession towards the Israelis. Now, if it's hard for them to make concessions because of that political culture, when you give them a pass, then you basically are telling them they never have to be responsible. If they're too weak to criticize, they're also too weak to be accountable.
In a way, you're feeding into what will ultimately be a completely non-productive approach.
I'm afraid, yes. What it does is it adds to the sense of irresponsibility on the Palestinian side. We want the Palestinians to be responsible. You know, if you're going to have a state, you don't build it on symbols. The Palestinian national movement has been fueled by a preoccupation with symbols. The only Palestinian leader who actually thought that you should build a state from the ground up, and he used to say it the way, in a sense, the Zionists had done it, the way Ben-Gurion had done it, was Salam Bayat. And he was their prime minister for a few years, and he was basically forced out. The idea that you can build a state by, you know, having a flag at the UN, as opposed to building institutions and a rule of law, more than anything else, that highlights what the problem is on the Palestinian side, and it makes it difficult to ever produce a two-state outcome.
I want to shift gears a little bit. There's a gigantic refugee crisis now, the greatest since the end of World War II. You're very familiar with the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, American allies. They seem to be doing about as little as humanly possible to assist the refugees coming out of Syria, coming out of Iraq, fleeing ISIS. Why do you think that is?
Look, I think we're getting at what is a deeper problem on the Arab side. Generally, you don't have leaderships that have a great deal of legitimacy. They, too, tend to focus on what can be a threat to their stability. Bringing in the refugees they see as being potentially destabilizing to them. There is an irony here. They don't seem to also have this deeper sense of responsibility to their Arab brothers. They may complain about these things, but you don't see a great openness to assuming a responsibility for absorbing them. I would put that first and foremost because their preoccupation tends to be security and survival, and anything that might affect their stability, they view through that lens. By the way, it's one of the reasons the book is called actually Doomed to Succeed, is that in the end, the U.S. relationship with Israel is very much shaped by the fact that there's only one democracy in the region, and that's Israel. There's only one state in the region that has real institutions and a rule of law, regularly and unregularly scheduled elections where the loser accepts the outcome, and that's Israel. And all of the other states don't have that. Lacking legitimacy makes them, first and foremost, very sensitive to anything they think that might affect their stability, and that's one of the reasons you see a deep reluctance to, I think, do anything beyond provide money for the refugees.
The delegitimization movement, BDS, academic areas, it isn't getting any smaller. It isn't losing steam, so far as I can tell. How has Israel responded to it? Do you think it's been effective in its hasbara and its public relations efforts? How does the what's the role of the United States government in dealing with it?
Well, you're raising really two important but different questions. First, I think the Israelis have not been able to shape a consistent strategy or message on this. First, within the government, there isn't the same, within the Israeli government, there, even though there's supposed to be one ministry in charge, there tends to be multiple actors who are dealing with this. And they need to do a better job of coordinating their own message, number one. Number two, it's not just Hasbara. They also need to be in a position where they can deny BDS the kind of veil that BDS has drawn over itself. BDS shifts attention away from a very interesting reality. Internationally, there's a consensus favoring two states. The BDS movement is against two states, but nobody knows it. And they don't know it because they tend to shift the focus onto Israeli settlement activity. And because you have some within the current Israeli government who actually reject two states, even though the prime minister is in favor of it, you get the focus on settlements, you get the focus on those who reject two states, and you don't get the focus on BDS, which is against two states. One of the reasons I have favored, and I say in the book at the end, it would help Israel a lot to blunt the delegitimization movement if Israel would make its settlement policy consistent with a two-state outcome. What I mean by that is, announce you're only going to build in what you think will be Israel, which includes the settlement blocks. You're not going to build in what you think will be the Palestinian state, and effectively, you don't build to the east of the security barrier where the blocks are today, and it means you wouldn't be building in 92% of the West Bank. Now, the minute Israel would do that, it could shift the focus onto BDS and say, well, look, we're for two states, but the delegitimization movement is about simply delegitimizing Israel. It's not about having a two-state outcome. And then you get the focus internationally in a different place, and I think that's very important. You can't, coming out and just saying that, you know, BDS is bad, coming out and not being able to shift the attention off of Israel's settlement policy makes it very difficult to somehow put Israel in a better light. If Israel is able to put itself in a better light, all the Hasbara will then reinforce this, and then you can, I think, put the spotlight on BDS where it needs to be, and it isn't right now.
Fascinating. What should the U.S. government approach to the BDS movement be?
Well, I think I would like to see the U.S. government also emphasize what I just said. Delegitimization is wrong because, in the first instance, it rejects the very idea of a two-state outcome. Now, we have two national movements competing for the same space. That's what Zionism is about. That's what the Palestinian National Movement is about. The only way to satisfy that is two states for two peoples. BDS is about one state and no Israel. And so the U.S. position ought to be BDS is wrong, BDS is against peace, BDS is against the only thing that could actually ever produce a kind of coexistence. BDS is not about coexistence. BDS is about rejection. I would like to see the American public position on BDS reflect something that I was just describing.
There's a presidential election coming up. Seems like we've already been in the process for, I don't know, a year, even though there's still a year to go before the votes get counted. Will the next president have an opportunity, because somehow the new president always gets involved in doing things in the Middle East and trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issue, if you will? Are there opportunities for a new president that don't exist, for example, with President Obama at this point?
Well, I think a new president, the one advantage a new president has is the president, he or she, comes in with what is a clean slate. President Obama at this point, particularly in the Middle East, in effect, his, fairly or not, has lost his credibility. When I go to the region now, if I put a blindfold on, I don't know who I'm listening to because they're all saying the same thing. And it goes back to not acting on the red line in Syria. It is seen in terms of doing the nuclear deal with Iran, which is perceived in the area as, in a sense, with sanctions relief in particular, freeing up Iran to increase its troublemaking in the region. The perception that the U.S. doesn't stand by its friends, again, fairly or not, is one that has taken root. When I go there, the Arabs tell me about how the Russians say to them, you may not like what we do, but look, we stand by our friends, the Americans don't. A new president can come in and has the opportunity to address those perceptions and to demonstrate that we do stand by our friends and to basically restore what I think is a perception of American reliability. I think that will have to happen. At this point, it doesn't matter what President Obama says, it will matter what he does, and I think, you know, his hesitancy, certainly as it relates to Syria, reinforces at this point, I think, the perceptions I was just describing. And, you know, in the world of policymaking, it's the perceptions that matter. That's what tends to end up governing others' behavior.
I want to thank Ambassador Dennis Ross for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His new book, Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama, is available everywhere. And it's a great read, as well as being extraordinarily important information, a great insight. And maybe the next president will make you the next Secretary of State. So we'll wait and see.
Yeah, I hope they just read the book and draw the lessons from the book, because if they draw the lessons from the book, they'll apply them and our approach will be, I think, significantly better grounded.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Rabbi Joel Osaran, Vice President of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, talking about the new anti-Semitism in Europe. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from Chava Alberstein, the great Israeli singer of Yiddish. It's called A Guter Zikaron, A Good Memory. May you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Amol is der zikoren oich ha-guter Vonaz men bet ba'im atoy v'tuter Er brengt amol zurik ha-shbiz derie Ablim el von der kindheit in em blien Und demol wacht oich hoiv der chush ha-reach Und zu dem over mit ha-sprung der geich Und dem wohl wacht euch auf der Chusch herreich Und zu dem Over mit der Sprung der Geich Amol ist der Zikoren euch a guter Und er ist mein Bett bei ihm a toi vetuter Er bringt amol zurück als bis der Rie Aber ihm will von der Kindheit in dem Blien Und dem wohl wacht euch auf der Chusch herreich Und zu dem Over mit der Sprung der Geich. Und dem Olwacht euch auf der Huscharech. Und zu dem Over mit der Sprung der Geich. Du Mama reißt die Hör mir mit dem Kämm. Mit Puter schmiert sie ohne weißen Semmel. Sie tut mir an die kinderische Kleider und führt mir ab zum Reben in einem Kämm.